Coming up, imagine you're building an online education site and you need to find the one topic that generates the most revenue. What topic would you say that is? I mean, really think about it. Put yourself in the entrepreneur's shoes who has to figure out what that topic is. What would you guess it is? You'll get the answer for today's guest in a moment. Also, if you were building a marketplace and you had that usual chicken and egg problem, can't get enough of this group of people unless you get enough of that group, but that group won't come unless this group comes, you know, the standard problem, how would you solve it? Challenge yourself to think about that, to come up with your answer. And in a moment, you're going to hear about the one partnership that solved it for today's guest. Also, what do you think is the big no-brainer decision for a startup entrepreneur? Today's guest will tell you towards the end of this interview. So watch that and so much more coming up. Listen up. I hate to have commercials interrupt this interview, so I'm going to tell you about three sponsors quickly now, and then we're going to go right into the program, starting with Walker Corporate Law. If you need a lawyer who understands the startup world and the tech community, I want you to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, I want to tell you about Shopify. When your friend asks you, how can I sell something online? I want you to send them to Shopify and explain to them that Shopify stores are easy to set up, they increase sales, and they'll make your friend's products look great. Shopify. Finally, I want to tell you about Grasshopper. Do you want a phone number that people can call and then press 1 for sales, 2 for tech support, etc., and have all of the calls be routed to the right person's cell phone? Well, get your number from grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How does a growth hacker figure out A, what his product is, and B, how to grow his customers? That's what we're going to find out in this interview. Last time he was on Mixergy, Gagan Biani talked about how he raised $1 million for his company. Well, soon after that, he and I had coffee privately, and he admitted to me that when he did the interview, he didn't even know what to spend his money on. He didn't know what his product was. He didn't know how to grow his business. He didn't know much. Since then, he seems to have figured it out. I invited him to talk about how he did it. Gagan is the co-founder of Udemy, a marketplace for online learning that has been doing incredibly well, as you'll see in this interview. He is also the co-founder of Growth Hacker Conference, a conference which, if you're interested in this interview, you'll probably want to attend. Gagan, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew. Really excited to be back on the show.
The day that you left and you're no longer at Udemy, no longer working there, what was the monthly revenue at the time?
I think we were doing about $300,000 a month in sales.
$300,000 a month in sales. And the typical course was what?
$50 maybe.
Somebody paying $50 to learn about how to do Word, how to do interviews like me, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, probably the most popular courses were how to learn Excel, and then a whole slew of courses after that were how to do development, web development, iOS development, et cetera, and you know, business advice as well.
You got to tell the audience what the guy who teaches how to learn Excel, what kind of revenue he generates. That'll blow their minds because they're going to look at this site at Udemy and they're going to say, oh, that course must be making a lot of money. The one about business and startups and software, that all must be But Excel's doing well. How much from Excel?
Yeah, so the guy on Excel in one day, we discovered the strategy really early on. We'll talk about it in the interview, I'm sure, but doing daily deals, essentially leveraging, you know, Groupon, Living Social.
Don't reveal too much. Otherwise, all joking aside, I want to really understand it step by step. I don't want to make it sound so simple. I just want to know, like, how big does one course get so that the audience sees this isn't a tiny company, Udemy, that we're bringing on. This is a guy who's, I mean, you guys have done really well in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, I know that the course has done over $500,000 in sales.
Okay. I have since found out that he exceeded $1 million in sales.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm pretty sure it's exceeded $1 million.
The very first course to $1 million was Excel, how to learn how to do Excel. Microsoft. All right, let's go back in time and really understand how you got to that, to a place where even one course can do that much, and you guys have tons of courses on the site. So you raised money. Most people would think, Gagan got to figure it out. Online learning, we understand the model. We understand that he's got $1 million. What's the problem? What problem were you having?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we had pretty much nothing figured out at that point. We didn't know who our customer was. We didn't know what product they were willing to buy. We hadn't even ever sold a course yet, so we didn't know whether or not they were willing to buy any product whatsoever in the online education space. And because the market was completely new, most people thought that we would have to go free and basically try to get as many users as possible. Not saying that wouldn't have been a good decision, but we ended up trying to provide as much value as possible in paid courses and being very successful that way.
Okay. So then what's the hunch that you thought? What did you think was going to be the model?
We thought that we would convince experts who had a lot of domain expertise and had an online brand to build online courses, put them on Udemy, and then promote them to their own audience.
I see.
And that they would be able to make money that way.
Even right from the beginning, you assumed whoever's creating the class is going to be the person promoting the class for us. We'll collect a share of the cash for facilitating the sale, but they're going to keep the bulk of it and they're going to do the promotion.
Yeah, that was always the plan from the beginning.
Okay, so what's the first step that you took?
The first step we took was trying to meet with as many potential instructors as possible. And so what we had was we hired a team of interns to basically... And then eventually we used outsourced labor in the Philippines, but it's effectively the same thing, who would basically mass email potential instructors in categories that we felt like were high value. You know, honestly, those categories were made on a hunch, so it's not like there's a lot of science there. But and then we'd mass email these instructors and we'd get on the phone with them via Skype, usually similar to this interview, and convince them to teach a course on Udemy.
Sorry, going back, did you start off with this team of interns, or can we take even a step further back where you were trying to figure it out? Where I actually heard from the pre-interview that you did with Jeremy that you talked to, let me see, you're going to do multimedia in the classroom. You are going to, you got a school to grant credit for any teacher who was taking a course that you guys were going to put together. Is that the first thing that you did?
No, that happened by accident, really, to be honest.
So first it was just getting interns and calling up people who you thought were teaching classes that were valuable. How did that work out?
Yeah, I mean, so before the interns, I did it myself for about 2 or 3 months, before we had even launched the product. But it's essentially the same process. It's just the resources that makes a difference. So, over the summer, before we raised $1 million, we had a team of interns who were basically mass emailing potential instructors, and they would schedule Skype calls on my calendar, and I would spend my entire day just Skype calling people, basically trying to convince them to join Udemy. And it kind of failed, really.
Why?
Honestly, we didn't have enough. We didn't have enough to offer the experts. They didn't find enough value and did not believe in us enough to put the time and effort associated into putting a course up. And so we could only get experts who were so desperate for the technology we built that they couldn't figure it out themselves. And since it wasn't very hard technology to figure out, it's just online video. I think we built a bunch of great technology eventually. But at that time, the only value we were really providing was streaming online video and a paywall. And that wasn't enough to convince people to use the product.
Okay. All right. So then what did you do?
So we then were lucky enough to raise money. So we got enough instructors. In retrospect, they weren't very good instructors, but we got enough instructors off of that to raise $1 million seed round and convince some investors to back us. And then we went and tried to figure out, okay, how are we going to get traction? Because we have no idea. And while pitching all these people on, these experts on teaching on Udemy, eventually we stumbled into something. My roommate was at the time this guy named Chris McCann, who is the founder, one of the two founders of Startup Digest, which was this like email newsletter that was basically blowing up at that time in Silicon Valley. I think now it probably has over 500,000 email subscribers, but at the time it was like hitting 100,000 and then 200,000. It was pretty fun. And we were like, hey, Chris, what if we like hosted an event and called it Startup Digest University? What if we created a partnership with Udemy and Startup Digest? And since he was in my living room and we all worked out of the same living room, it was a pretty easy sell.
Okay. And the idea there was what?
So we couldn't convince any experts to actually teach courses on our site. And yet at the same time, we had access to a lot of great experts, particularly our investors, right? So we had 11 investors, and they were all extremely successful entrepreneurs. And so we knew we could convince our investors to come and give a talk, right? So we could convince them to go and speak in front of like 60 to 70 entrepreneurs, because that's what they do every day, you know, a couple times a week at least, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we did is with Startup Digest, we created this thing called Startup Digest University, which was a in-person physical course held at in Palo Alto. We filmed the course. We invited the speakers to come in, sold tickets for like $30 or something. And that became the first course to be successful on Udemy.
Because Startup Digest had such a big reach that they basically sold it.
Yeah, exactly, pretty much.
and the course was your investors giving the kind of talk that they might have given at a conference.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we tried really, really hard to steer them away from the kind of talk that they give at a conference, because I think those talks generally are pretty average.
Yep.
Some of them did, of course, and there's nothing we can do about that, but a lot of them understood what we were trying to do and tried to teach something during their talk.
Okay. All right. And then do you remember how much revenue you generated from that?
Yeah, I think in the first email we generated like $20,000-$30,000, and to date it's probably been like, that course has probably crossed $100,000 in total sales.
And how much of that was online sales?
It was all online. We broke even on the physical event. We probably could have made a lot of money off the physical event actually, but it wasn't important to us. We just wanted to sell out. So we sold enough money off the physical event to cover the costs of paying the videographer to videotape and edit the conference or the event.
Okay. So what did we prove with that?
We proved two things. One, that people were willing to pay for high quality courses from experts on subjects that they, you know, we didn't know what subjects, but we knew one subject we had picked correctly, which in this case was raising capital for startups. The same subject that our Mixergy interview was on, ironically. But then the second thing that we learned was that we could use email lists or existing distribution partners as a method for promoting courses that would allow us to scale marketing in the early days much more quickly, really, than anything else I can imagine right now.
Yeah, it was huge. Now, when you saw that the Startup Digest guys were looking for an apartment, did you intentionally say, hey, you know what? If I have them move in with me, then I have access to their list?
No, definitely not. I did definitely think, hey, you know, my pitch to my roommates, which was my two other co-founders at the time, was, hey, like, when you, you know, we should have Chris stay at our place because he's super well-connected and it'll be like a fun little startup house. And also, it'll probably help us with our business in some way. I don't think I explicitly said, hey, it's going to help us with our business. But I think everybody kind of realized, like, hey, this is generally a good thing to have someone who's running another company that's successful living in our house.
Got it. Okay. But what is it about, by the way, before I move on with the rest of the story, what is it about entrepreneurs that you raised $1 million, he has hundreds of thousands of people in his list, and you still have to room up like college kids?
I mean, honestly, like, first of all, you don't pay yourself a lot when you are early on because you don't want to waste the money that your investors gave you. But second of all, I think it was a highly effective way for the team to work. It was, you know, you wake up. I was actually sleeping on an air mattress until we raised money. So I was sleeping on an air mattress in their house, and I would just wake up and walk, you know, 5 feet over and start working on the couch, you know. And my co-founders would then come in whenever they woke up. I was a business guy, so I tended to wake up because I had Skype calls at like 9 or 9:30. And then we'd work, and they'd work later than me, and I'd go to sleep, and then we'd just do it again. And honestly, I think in the early days, it's super valuable to have that kind of connection between the team. And then more importantly, you just should save money as much as possible in the early days, because you never know how long you're going to be. However, word of advice, being too thrifty is stupid. And a lot of entrepreneurs are way too thrifty. The other day I saw a blog post of someone talking about how he lived in Silicon Valley for $200 for the summer. That's not cool. It's not impressive, and I'm not excited about that at all. Like, you should spend money to make money. And so we were not cheap when it came to hiring the videographer. We paid him $5,000. Like, we could have found one that was a lot cheaper, but we knew that we just wanted high quality. We wanted to do well. And maybe it was like $3,000. Anyways, it was thousands of dollars. I didn't have my brother do it, is my
point. I see.
So I don't believe in being cheap, but I believe in being affordable and comfortable.
Okay, so now you've got an idea of what works, which is having people with brand names, like the speakers who you had, having a big audience. What do you do next?
After that, we started to scale it. And so obviously the first thought was, okay, we've taught raising capital for startups. What other courses can we teach on the Startup Digest University brand? And we started to do, we did one on hiring for startups and then social marketing for startups. And those were the next two courses, and they did almost as well, but not as well as the raising capital course. And sort of by the time we were on the third one, we realized, wow, this is a ton of work. Like wrangling all these speakers together and lining up events is not what I think is the right way for us to actually grow this company. And
okay,
so
let's put a pin in there for a second and ask about a question that will come to someone's mind if they're going to try to do something like you, which is, Chris could have taken your idea and said, Startup Digest doesn't have enough of a revenue model. Hey, we can do these courses once a month. We sell our own tickets, and then we sell the videos online, and we don't need this Goggin guy and his partners. We'll cut him out and earn 100% of the revenue and keep 100% of the revenue. Why wasn't that an issue?
Well, I think it's two things. First of all, they did eventually decide that they didn't want to do online education courses and did essentially not cut us off, but cut any promotion off the top of their list because they cared more about the value of their list. They didn't want to basically – they thought it was like spamming their list. I highly disagree. I thought that the list loved Startup Digest University and they really had a missed opportunity there. But what did end up happening is AppSumo ended up doing exactly what you're talking about. And so
– they were your second partner.
Yeah, our second big partner did, and Noah's brilliant, and so he was smart enough to figure this out. He was like, wow, these online courses sell really well. We should start doing them on our own, and they did. And it took them a while to get to the scale that we were, so they still worked with us for a while. But eventually, it did end up being like one of those things where I think they found that they had more – they wanted more Apple-style control over the content and the courses they were promoting. And so they did end up doing that.
So was that a mistake then, partnering up with these guys who are aggressive, who are eager for revenue, and who could easily copy your model?
No, not at all. I mean, we benefited more perhaps from Noah's brilliant marketing than he did from our brilliant idea. I mean, I think it was very – I'm sure Noah would tell you that he came up with the idea himself, like whatever, that's his prerogative, but we were the first online course to be successful on his platform. I know the numbers. And so the point is, like, we gave him the idea, I think, and he taught us marketing. Honestly, we looked a lot at AppSumo early on to learn how to market and essentially growth hack. And I view Noah, though he did not do this intentionally, as kind of like a mentor because we would just follow everything they were doing and learn from him.
It was such a stressful relationship because you were each learning from each other and trying to see who's going to zoom out faster.
Yeah, I mean, I was never really stressed out about it. And I don't think he was either.
Sure you were.
Don't get me wrong. There was clear, like, I think, you know both of us very well. So for you, it's like you've seen this on both sides. Like, clearly there was some competitive angst between the two parties. And we would often have negotiations where I felt like there was something we weren't being told, which is really rare in conversations with startup entrepreneurs. And so don't get me wrong, there was. But at the same time, it's like our company was growing like a rocket ship in large part because of the fact that Noah had knew how to build a huge list. And so we were just happy to be along for the ride, frankly.
Okay. All right. And I do see that. I wanted to bring it up because that is a legitimate issue that someone listening to this who's trying to duplicate what you've done is going to have. And frankly, it turned out well for both of you that you did learn from each other. You did end up going in your own separate directions. The next thing that you did, was it getting AppSumo or was it another distribution channel, or was the next thing to find another person to teach because you guys couldn't keep teaching?
No, it was another person to teach. So it was, you could do either one, frankly. I think that the you know, you're balancing supply and demand. And in our case, we didn't have to balance. We had no balance issues. We just had to increase supply and then correspondingly increase demand. And so supply being courses and demand being people who want to take those courses.
I see. And you couldn't just keep being a course production company because?
Because we knew that wouldn't build a marketplace. Marketplaces are built by liquidity. And liquidity requires both supply and demand being happy with when they come to your site, essentially. If an instructor comes to your site, they should be able to find students. And if a student comes to your site, they should be able to find things to learn.
What about this, though? I look at my stats to see where my customers are coming from. I think the number one source for new customers from Google is people searching for how Lynda.com built her business. I did an early interview with her. Yes, so they come from Google to watch that interview. They buy premium so that they can watch and copy what she did. What she does is, and what they're trying to learn from is how to produce your own courses. And it's worked incredibly well for her. Very, very successful company. She produces it herself, or at least it did in the beginning. Why didn't you guys go in that direction? Why did you have to have a marketplace?
I mean, I think we're going to eat their lunch, frankly, if we are successful at what we're doing. And the reason is because it's really great to have end-to-end control in the beginning of your company. But eventually, marketplaces always not always, you know, there are definitely situations where this isn't true. But marketplaces frequently beat vertically integrated businesses because marketplaces scale much more quickly. And so like in, I think, a year and a half, we covered what Lynda.com was able to create in 10 years in terms of topics, in terms of having one course for every topic they had.
Okay.
And in terms of quality, which is the main potential sort of like counter argument to this, I think that you would see that most of our courses were better than Lynda.com courses in terms of the instructor's credibility, because the instructor got a lot more out of a Udemy course than out of a Lynda course. And so Lynda eventually runs into this issue of having a lot of mediocre people teach their courses, and a lot of mediocre people write books for O'Reilly for the same reasons, because the publisher takes so much damn money that the best people don't bother with Lynda because Lynda isn't giving them enough money.
Okay. I don't know that I agree with her with that statement that she has mediocre people. She gets...
I think she has better than average people, but I think we have amazing people and really shitty people. Like, I think we have the top and the bottom, and she probably has this like this sliver right here that's good enough for her, but I don't think you get the absolute best or the cutting edge stuff when you give people 10% of the revenue from the course. I just don't think that's – the economics just don't make sense.
I don't think she does 10%, but I hear what you're saying. Your point is solid. I think it's one of the few NDAs that I signed where I said I couldn't reveal how she pays her people. But it's okay, not well, the biggest.
I know the exact sort of – I know numbers that I've heard from other people. And
no, you can say it. You don't have an NDA.
Yeah, I don't.
So say it.
And so it's between, you know, $3,000 to $5,000 is an often sort of upfront amount. I'm sure she goes way above that and way below that, depending on the person. But it's basically an advance against royalties, and then they give royalties to instructors based on the number of minutes that video is watched compared to all the total minutes on the site. It's a very complicated formula, but that's what I've heard from other instructors who've done like 7 to 10 courses on Lynda before.
Okay. So now I see why, despite the difficulty, you decided we have to stick with the marketplace. I see you have your big audience. I see you have your trouble creating content because you're not a content creator and it doesn't make sense for you. What's the next? Is this when you went to Zed Shaw, or are you starting to – what happened with Zed Shaw? Who is Zed Shaw and what happened with him?
Yeah, so Zed Shaw is a extremely well-known Python programmer and sort of now author and instructor. You know, he wrote a book about a year before I approached him called Learn Python the Hard Way. It's an ebook that he put up on the internet and basically just like didn't pay attention to for like 6 months. Just so happened that over that 6 months to a year, you know, it's been downloaded 500,000 times. I know I use the word 500,000 a lot. Like this is really important to understand. 500,000 people downloading your book is a fuck ton of people. Like that is not a small amount. That book went viral like anything else. And so he had a ton of people who wanted this book, and he put up like a little donation page and was basically not really making any money off the book. because A, he wanted to help people for free, but B, because he honestly, I don't think he really realized that he could have. So I reached out to him knowing that he had a successful book and said, hey, Zed, would you like to teach on Udemy? You know, interesting competitive thing. I will tell you that when the reason we reached out to Zed specifically, although many other instructors don't come from competitor sites, it was because we did see him on another company's site that we thought was kind of subpar. We thought that company was not doing a very good job of marketing them. Ooh. And I'm not going to name the name. Too much. Like, I'm already being rude enough about the company, frankly. Okay. Like, I respect the guy who started it. He's a really smart dude. He just didn't know marketing the way we did. Anyways, so we went on to that site and we found out that we did not steal from people who we had personal relationships, for the record. So like, whereas at other companies that I've been involved with or whatever, I've seen a very, very fierce competition. Udemy never had that philosophy. But at the same time, like, if we think an instructor is getting screwed because they're on the wrong site, like, we're going to tell that instructor, hey, we can make you more money.
Okay, and so then you see a guy who's popular, who's already teaching online and is open to it on a subpar platform, in your opinion. So you say we go after him. How open was he to it?
Very open. Yeah. I mean, we never really talked about the competitor site. I don't think even to this day, Zed knows that that's how we found him. In fact, nobody knows because this is the first time I've admitted it publicly.
Good.
We had coffee at this place in Nob Hill in San Francisco, and I pitched him on the idea. I had no clue if he was going to do it or not, but I told him, hey, we'll email you out to the like 200,000 people on Startup Digest newsletter. And he was in. And then I created a fake deadline. So I was like, hey, Zed, we've got a digest going out in mid-March, and the rest of them are all like booked for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Would you be able to get it done before then? And obviously, I made up the whole thing about – and he probably knew. I mean, he's a really smart guy. He probably saw right through me. But that fake deadline got it done quicker because speed is of the essence when you're an early-stage company. And we got it out by mid-March, and it was by far the most successful course that Startup Digest had promoted.
Really? How much did that bring in?
So actually there's another course in here that I don't like to talk about because I'm a little embarrassed about the quality of that course in retrospect, but there was another course called the Learn How to Build iPhone Apps in 24 Hours or in 2 days or something like that, which was made, and that course actually did better than Zed's, but both did quite well. I think that course probably did like $50,000 in one day, something ridiculous. And Zed's probably did like 25 or 30. Both of those were sent 1 week after another, so who knows what Zed's would have done if it was the first course instead of the second course.
Okay. I got to ask you about one thing that's not on the notes here, and remember, the integrity, the journalistic integrity comes first, above our friendship, above everything else. You guys at Startup Digest also ran 4 guides that Mixergy created, where we took past interviewees, I paid a writer, April Dykeman, to... who's now a consistent contributor to Mixergy, to turn those into guides on how to do a lean launch. How did that play into what you did, would play into your model and be just as open as you were ripping into other products when you're talking about mine, or complimentary? Be honest is what I mean.
Okay. So first of all, you have an incredible brand. Obviously, I actually told you this on last time, but like one of the things that I do to help, and I'm doing this now again because I'm starting a new company, is watch videos of other entrepreneurs and sort of like observe them and learn from them. And I used to watch Mixergy videos all the time back when I was starting Udemy. And so I obviously respected your ability to interview. The guides didn't work, I don't think. I don't really remember, honestly. It's like, we did a lot of different partnerships like that, and it wasn't one but it didn't work super well. And I think the reason is, and this isn't going to be that helpful to your audience, but I think the reason is that like written stuff just didn't sell as well as video. And also they weren't teaching a specific topic. They were often more about a person. And so similar to this interview where it's about me, though I think people will learn a lot, it's more about me than it is about the learning. When the person takes precedence over the learning, it's very difficult to sell that course, I think.
I see. Actually, I find that too, that if we were to do a course on Mixergy, essentially you and me talking and teaching growth hacking, for example, as opposed to doing an interview about how you did it, you get more attention to growth hacking as a topic. Even if we sell it, more people will watch it than will listen to your story. But what the reason I'm asking is, it seems like what you were doing was just throwing stuff out there and testing to see what were people interested in. Did they like the idea of a course? Remember, even Noah used to call things entrepreneurial training. Used to call it courses. Used to call, I forget, all kinds. It seems like that's what you guys were doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, in any given situation, it's extremely difficult to know what is going to work and what's not going to, particularly when you're talking about like sending an email blast to, you know, 100,000 people or something. And so all you can do is make your best determinations, do a lot of customer development. So you're talking to users and understanding what they want to learn, and then try a lot of shit, right? Like throw a lot of shit at the wall and see what sticks.
Okay. So in addition to all these epic steps forward, there were also a bunch of things that you tried that are not even memorable.
Yeah, so we actually haven't gotten to that part of the story yet. So actually, so far, everything we did, I didn't miss anything in this okay. time period so far. Everything went well. Like, it was almost as though we could do no wrong.
The Mixergy guides didn't do so well for you.
But your Mixergy guides were after this. That's what I'm saying. So,
I'm jumping forward. All right.
A few months later. Yeah, I'll give you the rest of the story real quick here. And stop me, of course.
I will anytime we need to dig deeper, but go ahead.
Yeah, so after these two courses went on Startup Digest, we had now figured out how to convince instructors to teach courses on Udemy, which was, hey, teach this course and we'll promote you on this platform, essentially. And so we had solved the proverbial chicken and egg problem, right? We knew that we could get the chicken if we just dangled the egg in front of them and essentially then just, you know, put them together. And so over the next 3 months, we brought on our first business hire and we started bringing on a team of engineers, because at that point we were like, all right, this business is ready to go.
Okay.
So keep in mind, until then, this is 9 months after we raised our seed round. As you said, I think we had spent like maybe $130,000 or $40,000 out of $1 million. I mean, in 9 months, that's like unheard of. And yet, at that point, we all of a sudden ramped up from 3 full-time employees all the way up to 8 or 9 by the end of the summer. And so we were not shy. When it was time to go balls to the wall, we went and hired and brought on a team and made sure we could go execute. But when it wasn't, we were very cautious and kind of like, you know, in our shell, sort of like slowly waiting for the right moment. Anyway, so we then went and actually, you know, we were very – very lucky in that we happened to have a very good network of sort of entrepreneurs that we knew. So we started to promote that these people were successful teaching courses. And so we were able to get a lot more instructors sort of through the intern strategy. But this time we could say Zed Shah made $40,000, Best Ho made $60,000, whatever, whatever, whatever. And so that proof point was required to convince more instructors to come on board. And then on the flip side, On the demand side, we were able to reach out to every email list on the planet and tell them the Startup Digest numbers. So we would give them explicit numbers. I don't remember them right now. Sorry, Andrew. But it's like 200,000 people got – so these are going to be fake. But 200,000 people got the email, you know, 15% conversion to landing page, 5% actually bought it. And so we ended up making this much money. We think if we did it on your platform, since it's new, it'll probably do this much money, right? And we wouldn't often, obviously, we wouldn't be stupid enough to promise an exact dollar amount, but we would say, like, look, we think this is going to do really well on your platform. And so we convinced people like Startup Weekend. We convinced people like these random email lists in various cities around the country. At one point, I think I still have the spreadsheet because I've always been planning on using it again at some point for another course. But basically, we had this huge spreadsheet. I mean, you're talking like 40, 50 email lists and publications that we would reach out to and have relationships with that had anywhere between 10,000 to, you know, 250, 500,000 people on their email list. And we would track, okay, what, you know, when did they respond? Basically like a CRM on Excel, right? Or on Google Spreadsheets. And then we would send out emails and see what the conversion rates were. We'd figure out what topics would be successful. And so we were manually creating this marketplace from scratch for the next couple of months. And during that time, we had a lot more successes and failures. So during that time, we had a lot more situations where certain email lists sucked. They didn't have engagement, and so they didn't work. And we had a lot of degradation. So Startup Digest was doing really well, and it didn't continue to do as well. It did, you know, sort of less well. Similar to what the Daily Deals are seeing now, we just saw that much quicker. And then we had massive – and then we had failures. Like I think the Mixergy guides was an example of a failure. I can't remember every other one, but we had plenty of them, courses that just didn't do very well. And then we had also massive successes. So we had a course that went out on AppSumo and sold like $65,000, $70,000 in one day. That was the same iOS course that sold like 40 or 50 on Startup Digest. And that course, I think, whether Noah admits it or not, was the aha moment for him that like, holy shit, this is like one of our best selling deals ever. And this guy, like who I ignored for 3 months, convinced me to do it. And it was a blockbuster, basically.
How did you get him to say yes? His whole business model was called, it was called AppSumo. It was about getting apps to people at discounts, and you were giving him a course.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I think persistence. I was like pretty much, I probably emailed him every 2 weeks because I knew it was such a big opportunity. And then more importantly, I gave him the numbers. I think like the numbers were probably more effective than the persistence, but I bet the persistence helped just like make sure he knew he couldn't ignore me. And so the numbers really were that like, hey, you have a list of this size. This is the percentage conversion rate. Like this is going to kill it for you. And at some point I think he's like, all right, it's worth a shot.
I see. Yeah. You know what? That is the way to get to Noah. On a professional level, the way to get to his heart is by showing him numbers. Everyone just wants the schmooze. Show him some facts.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, like for all of this, I will tell you, I think he, like I have more respect for Noah than almost any other growth hacker marketer in the business. So like I very much respect this guy. And so when I talk about competition, I think of it as a very friendly thing. Like I think of it as a very mutual respect situation.
Yeah, no question. I mean, when you see it up close, you can see how good he is at this stuff. It just comes naturally. It's almost frustrating how natural it comes to
him. I know. It's crazy.
Especially when you're like, I remember struggling to figure stuff out. And then I call him up and the guy's doing just frisbee golf while he's solving the problem that was epic for you.
Yeah.
Totally. I feel in many ways you're like that too. You're not about to throw a golf frisbee, a frolf, I guess is what it's called, while we're talking, but you are very methodical in what you're doing. And that's why you make for a good interview. Anyone who, by the way, has not seen the interview about how to raise money that you and I did together has got to go back and get that. Because as I said at the top, let me read to you the way that I even introduced that. Where is that? There it is. Here, look, I'm even proud of the intro that I had. Even if you have zero interest in raising money, you'll want to hear this interview for the same reason the chess masters like to watch each other play. If you listen to this interview, you're going to hear how a methodical thinker systematically knocks obstacles out of his way and creates opportunities. That's what was exciting about watching you in that first interview. You just said, I'm a nobody. How do I become a somebody? All right. Well, TechCrunch people respect that. I'll go write a couple of articles for there. Well, there are all these events. I'll go do that. Really great interview. All right, but getting back to this, no more sidetrack. Are you getting Skype messages from Lyft as we're talking? Is that where your attention just went?
Sorry, I just had to send an email saying I'm missing the next meeting, so I'm just going to skip it. Let's keep going.
All right, skip it. Good. This is more important. I want to take I want to segue for a second to something you said earlier, which is you had to raise more money. What's it like to go from raising $1 million as quickly as you did to suddenly having to do a Series A? What was the difference in raising money?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it was completely different. I did not even come close to anticipating. And honestly, I think it was one of my biggest personal failures at Udemy was the way that I handled our Series A fundraising. And it's because they needed a lot more than what angel investors wanted. Angel investors look at potential, and in terms of everything from the way that you present yourself, like I did not change my personality in my VC meetings, but I felt like I needed to be much more professional than I was in angel meetings. Angels are attracted to hustlers, and VCs are attracted to professionals. Angels are attracted to businesses that could work. VCs are attracted to businesses that do work. Angels don't need a whole lot of data or numbers. They just want to see one glimmer of hope that like this business could become really big. And VCs want to make sure that every piece of data is pretty solid.
For example, what surprised you? What kind of data did they need?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest mistake we made is we didn't do any engagement data analysis whatsoever. So we were just straight up growth hacker, like focused entirely on acquisition and on sort of like getting users. Not only do I regret that from the standpoint of raising money, you know, raising money is at the end of the day kind of an annoying obstacle in the way of building a really big company. And so, you know, getting great investors is not annoying. I think great investors provide tremendous value, but actually the act of actually getting them to give you their money is the part that's annoying. And so that said, like, I wish going back, we had focused more on engagement on all parts of the product, because I think that would have built for a more defensible and sustainable long-term business. And I think we've now just realized that and are switching significantly over to that and doing a really good job.
What do you mean by engagement?
Getting people to finish courses. So people would buy courses, and oftentimes it's kind of like buying a book. Of the number of books that you buy, how many do you actually read and how many sit on your shelf?
And investors wanted to know that.
Yes.
They didn't just want to know, how are you getting your customers? How are you closing your deals?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's exactly what we missed. And so, you know, in retrospect, during the Series A fundraising, like the big thing I missed as an entrepreneur was, hey, like, these questions that VCs are asking about engagement are not stupid, which is what I thought at the time, of course. And don't get me wrong, I thought engagement was important. So I had other engagement metrics that I thought were important, but they weren't around the core question of, do people love this product? And like, honestly, people did love our product and they still do. Like, I'm sure that you have at least heard from people that they take courses on Udemy and love it, like anecdotally while talking to people at conferences or something. Or they've taken courses from you and loved them.
So how do you know that people, well, did you say, honestly, people did not love it at the time?
No, I think people did love the courses.
So how do you know if they love it? Not just watch it all the way through, but love it.
Yeah. So a lot of them who love it don't watch it all the way through, right? Like, I love Mixergy, but I don't watch every interview, right? Like, is that a fair expectation?
So what is a good way to measure happiness and engagement? We're always thinking about that too.
Yeah, I mean, you have to do a combination of a whole bunch of things, because the reality is that just looking at the data is usually not sufficient. So I would look at the data, and obviously there's a ton of data things like monthly actives versus daily actives, like how much time are they spending on your site, et cetera, et cetera. All of those basic engagement metrics are really important. But then on top of that, you got to talk to your users and talk to people who have bought your courses, understand why they bought them and whether they're satisfied. And surprisingly, similar to books, people were satisfied to buy courses and not watch them all the way through. Like, it doesn't actually matter to them. Sometimes they just wanted 20 minutes worth of advice on something, and like, to them it was worth paying $50 so that they would have access to the rest of the advice when it's time. And then, of course, that's not great, but like, the one thing our investors missed when they were looking at our business is every other business that claimed to have engagement actually didn't have any better engagement than we did. So like, people who were raising money at the time were like Skillshare and Codecademy. And like, it's kind of a joke that those guys acted like they had more engagement than we did, because the reality is, like, the full course completion was roughly the same rates for almost every company, right? Like, and you know, you look at Udacity and Coursera, who have now come up since then, and like, they have similar problems, right? Like, the number of people who actually get through those courses is always less than 10%, always, always, always. And it's very rare. Sometimes you can find it 15%, but it's never higher than that. Does that mean people don't like online education? Does that mean like online courses are bunk? Obviously not, right? Like it just means that, you know, people like having access to this knowledge, and they don't need to go through the whole thing to be satisfied with it. Like, I read the first 50 pages of a business book and the rest is just reference for me usually.
Okay. All right. So now, fair point. It's kind of frustrating point also.
Yeah.
You know, at least in a restaurant, the guy can walk around and say, are people eating all the food? All right. If they are and they're coming back, then I know that I've got happy customers. You're right. If Barnes & Noble were able to look at every single book that I read, they might think Andrew hates business books because he never completes them, or rarely does. But in reality, I complete the ones I want to and don't the ones I don't. All right, let's continue here then. Now what we've got is a business that figured out what it's about. I think you were at this point doing $100,000 in revenue. I'm looking at my notes here. Then yeah. You started to do paid acquisition. Why did you shift to paid acquisition, and what did you do?
Yeah, so I'm going to close the loop a little bit here on timeline. We were doing 100,000 about like June or July or something in 2000, I think this is a 2011 probably. And we raised our round kind of immediately after that. During our fundraising process, we actually just kept growing. So I think we grew to like 150, maybe 170. And then at some point we realized that like these email lists were not going to drive any more additional revenue. And oh, by the way, like at the same time, AppSumo was kind of not favoring us as much as they were in the beginning. In the beginning, honestly, we were on AppSumo like every 5 days. It was ridiculous. And they were driving an inordinate percentage of our revenue at the time, and we realized, and they probably realized that we were driving an inordinate percentage of their sales. And so we realized like, hey, all these email lists generally are seeing degradation on their lists. They're not doing as well as they were in the beginning. And so even though we're out executing, and so we're basically like drastically increasing the number of total reach, so we're getting to Groupon, Living Social, we're starting to get to much bigger lists. It was clear, the writing was kind of on the wall, that this list strategy was going to end eventually. And so we had to find another strategy. And one of the obvious things was like, okay, can we advertise and profitably? And so we started to explore that really deeply. My co-founders had a lot of experience in paid acquisition. And so it was actually really easy for us to get up and running and start. And we kind of like leveraged their expertise to build a lot of that infrastructure early on over the next couple of months.
What's the first paid acquisition test that you guys ran?
I couldn't even tell you. I mean, it's probably a Facebook ad for raising capital for startups or for learn how to build iOS applications. I mean, we always promoted a specific course on Facebook or Google, and then they would come to our page and we would ask them for their email, and then we'd email them about any course. And so like that was sort of the funnel that we had, you know, and we still kind of have that to this day, although we're just way less reliant upon that than we were before.
So the user sees the ad on Facebook, clicks over, comes to your site. You say, can't do anything until you give me your email address. They give you the email address. Then what they see is an ad for a course.
Yeah, effectively. I mean, we call it, you know, the course profile page. It is kind of an ad, but it's also like it provides real value and real information. It's not built just to be an advertisement.
Okay. And is that the point? Is that the point in the story where things start to shift away from you to your co-founders and the rest of the team because you don't have experience in paid ads?
I mean, I still was responsible for all of our supply side marketing. So I required all of our instructors still. And then the responsibilities of the team just grew significantly at that point. So it didn't make sense for, none of the founders any longer needed to have deep expertise in like a lot of things. We just had to have deep expertise in one and two things because we had a team of people who could build expertise in other parts. And so, yeah, to some extent, my role diminished when we did paid acquisition because it was on the demand side. We didn't need me for marketing, but at the same time, like I still ran the marketing team and also focused entire. And so like, no, I don't think so really.
Okay. How effective was paid ads for you guys?
It was mediocre, to be honest. I think like in retrospect, it took us about 6 months to do it. To figure out that it was working, but not well enough to scale to like really large numbers. So it scaled us from, I don't know, you said Aaron said I could say all the numbers, right?
Yeah. So let me say this to you that, I was worried that because we were friends, that maybe as an interviewer, I would drop my guard and I would let you say everything. Like I did everything. I'm the greatest. I ran this company. And meanwhile, you're not at the company anymore. So I just, In our interviewee meeting where we were talking about guests, Alex, who books the guests, and Jeremy, who pre-interviewed you and I, were sitting around and I said, let's talk to his co-founder and check it out. So I frantically emailed Aaron. I got on the phone with him and I went through it all. I said, did Goggin really raise the money? Did Goggin really help you guys figure out where the model was? Nice. And he said, yes, yes, he did. He confirmed it. He's the one who told me about the Excel spreadsheet course. He told me a bunch of stuff, and he did say that he wanted to be open with everything. He actually said he was going to go get me some numbers, but I talked to him yesterday, so he still hasn't emailed me back. So my sense is say everything except within reason, and I think he's comfortable revealing revenue. He told me I could have the exclusive and talk about revenue because you guys haven't in a while, but maybe because he didn't email it to me, what we'll do is we'll wait on the actual revenue number till the interview is posted and he can say it in the comments. So I'll ask the audience if you guys want to hear that. If it's important, put it in the comments. So now with that in mind, what were you going to say?
So, I mean, I can talk about these are old numbers anyways. You could intimate these from many different press mentions. So I think at that point we went from like $150,000 to maybe like $300,000 off of paid acquisition, we thought. So at the time, we thought that it was paid acquisition that was doing a lot of these sales. We couldn't track it. So, you know, with paid acquisition, you can track every user you acquire through paid acquisition, how much revenue they're doing. And the total revenue from paid acquisition was not adding up. And so Aaron and I were scratching our heads to figure out, like, what was this difference? Like, where was this difference coming from? I think at the time, the theory was that the difference came from people seeing the ads but then buying separately. Like basically a missed attribution problem. I think that was somewhat true, but actually like the big part of our growth to date now is our instructors and our users telling their friends. And so instructors telling their audiences and then users telling their friends. And honestly, we just like really missed the ball there. Like we ignored that channel and did not cultivate it and focus enough on just getting our users to continue to love our product. And we were lucky in that people did love our product, so they shared it anyways. But in classic sort of growth hacker in the weeds mentality, we missed that. And paid acquisition was, in a lot of ways, I think, a distraction that was somewhat healthy. I mean, we learned a ton and we did still grow. But I think we now have our heads on straight a lot better at the company, where we focus a lot more on making sure people just love our courses and instructors promote our courses.
What did you learn from paid that you didn't know otherwise?
I mean, the level of detail that we got to on the metrics side was incredibly valuable for me.
And so what did that help you guys do?
Well, I don't know that it helped you to me as much as it did me personally.
What do you mean?
Aaron was already really good at this, so he didn't need to learn it. I mean, seeing it again when he's entirely responsible for the budget is probably a little bit different. You know, he's CEO, et cetera. But at the same time, like, he kind of already knew this stuff. I had never spent money on marketing in my life before, right? And so for me, seeing the details of how we went about calculating lifetime value and our customer acquisition costs, and then seeing how different campaigns performed, was extremely valuable in cultivating me as a performance marketer, as opposed to simply a sort of like a guy who knew how to do very small time affiliate business development deals.
One of your advisors is John Bischke, who I used to live next door to in Santa Monica. And,
oh, cool.
He did Edufire, and he told me that he had a vision for the teachers being teacherpreneurs. Teacherpreneurs meaning entrepreneurs who taught and sold what they taught, and he was going to give them tools to sell it. It seems like that's what worked best for you, as you said. What do you do to make your instructors teacherpreneurs and help them really recruit their friends and their followers to come and buy?
Yeah. So ironically, we teach them how to market on their courses.
What do you teach them?
All sorts of things. You know, we teach them how to write great blog posts. We teach them how to get featured in newspapers and not newspapers, sorry, like in blogs. I just didn't want to be repetitive there, but you know, like tech blogs, like TechCrunch or something like that. We teach them how to cultivate their email lists and how to create great courses. I mean, one of the biggest things we focus on now is we have a whole team that's entirely dedicated to make sure course quality is high. Those are all the things that we started to teach them. And how do we teach them? We email them like crazy. We put blog posts. We have a Facebook group that's super active. We just engage with them on a constant level. Those instructors have started to become very, very successful. I mean, we're talking about, we've minted a millionaire. I think we've easily minted people who are like, you know, making $100,000 to like $250,000 a year. I'm sure there's like dozens of them.
Who became a millionaire?
Well, so the thing about the Excel course is, and the reason why we don't get the same kind of credit for it that I wish we did, is that it was kind of a company that started that course. So the instructor got a share of it, but that company was a lot like Lynda. And so given my sort of like somewhat animosity towards Lynda that you heard about earlier, because I think they kind of screw their teachers a lot. And while I love the business they built, I think that it's really not as good for the teacher as people say. And so this was kind of that situation, and I feel kind of bad about it still. Like, I wish we had found a specific instructor to teach Excel. And actually, at the time, I had pitched many people on it, but these guys already had the content created, and we promoted it on Udemy, and it killed it, really. And so we minted a millionaire business, essentially. Like, that business made $1 million off of that course. I don't think they made $1 million. I think they did $1 million of sales, but, you know, still made a lot of money.
I also see what one of the things you guys did was go after people who already knew how to sell. They just didn't know how to sell individual products. Like, I asked Tim Sykes, I said, you're selling a tremendous amount of content on your own. Why do you need to partner with Udemy? They're not really sending you any new customers. Maybe you guys were because you have a mailing list. And he said... Right. I don't have the technology to sell individual courses, and I don't want to create it. These guys do it. He, before you, I think, I could be wrong, was selling DVDs in the mail.
Yeah.
Higher perceived value. There's a system for selling it. There was no system for selling the online stuff.
Yeah. So remember in the beginning of this conversation, I said that, like, early on, instructors who already had their own promotional vehicles didn't find it valuable to use us. Well, eventually we built a set of technology that actually was valuable enough for those people. And then more importantly, we had a marketplace that had credibility. So, like, you know, before, people didn't really even know that they could sell an online course. So Tim Sykes is a great example of someone who was like, people will buy this digitally. Like, I don't have to have my parents, like, put together these DVD boxes and mail them individually to all of our clients. Like, and I was like, yeah, we're doing it. We've made millions of dollars. Like, we've sold millions of dollars. People are doing it all over the time. That was a big thing. So it wasn't just like the Udemy technology. It was actually just, hey, this actually works. And this is proof. You know, Kickstarter is a great example of that, of like, now everybody believes it works, but can you imagine being pitched on Kickstarter as a way to start your hardware company like 5 years ago? You would have told them they were crazy.
I just lost the question that I wanted to ask you. So instead, I'm going to move on to the other question. Since I've been revealing how I do my research here, people have already known that I have a pre-interviewer, that we have someone here who does research. I have a researcher. The other thing I did is I talked to your competitor. Smaller competitor, I said, what should I be asking? And he said, ha, he was surprised that I would even email him. He goes, ha, well, they only take a small percentage of the sale. Long term, that doesn't seem like enough to grow the business. What other revenue models has he tried, or what other revenue models is he seeing that work?
Yeah, I'm curious what competitor that is. I'm sure you intentionally left it out.
I promised him that I wouldn't say, but it's a small guy that you may not even know of. I want to know what a new person starting out would be curious about.
Makes sense. I mean, I just believe it's a huge opportunity. We don't need to take more money to be profitable. I never really got people who asked us about additional revenue streams. Like, if you look at the most successful businesses, look, my goal is not to become a business that, like, does, you know, $60, $70 million in sales. It's to become a business that's doing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's to become Airbnb or Kickstarter in any business that I start. And so when my co-founders and I were talking about share and revenue streams, we never thought there would be another revenue stream. We're going to take, you know, 30% of the revenue, and we're going to provide as much value to instructors, and we're going to mint a bunch of millionaires, and on the way, we'll mint ourselves as well.
And 30% is not small.
Yeah, I don't think it's that small either.
What was the revenue that you guys did last year? That I know you can say. 2012.
I look at numbers very differently. So, you know, I think it's like 3 to 5 million probably last year. I don't know actually the exact number.
And the company launched in 2009. So we're talking about within 3 years, over 3 million in revenue.
Yeah. But I mean, we really did not start until December of 2010. Like,
not only that, I was kind of embarrassed at myself for pointing that out, because not only is it not really 3 years of building this, it was some time figuring it out, but frankly, once you've raised money and you're starting to do some paid ads, I don't necessarily know that there's... Well, anyway, I'll put it out there. I'll leave it there. But I don't know how to explain my lack of confidence in the way that I explained it. I don't think that's the right way to look at where you guys are.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would say that we are a success, but not a blockbuster success yet. I think we still have to keep growing. But the thing that I think that is particularly impressive about the company compared to any of the other companies out there in online education is we have consistently grown pretty much every month. You know, we have down months. We don't have down months, but we have even months every once in a while. But we've grown pretty much every month since January of 2000 and January 2011. January 2011. That's 1 month after December 2010. So really, it's when we started. So since we've been doing paid courses on Udemy, we have grown every single month almost. And when that's 6 months, it's interesting. When it's 12 months, it's cool. When it's 24 months, it's like, what the hell is going on? Like, this company knows what they're doing. And that's why I think we are, you know, in a lot of ways considered to be some of the best marketers in online education.
Why are there trophies over your shoulder?
Oh, shoot. I didn't even realize that. Those are from high school. I'm in my home, my parents' home in Fremont. And, you know.
In your old bedroom. Why are you living in your parents' house?
I'm not. I live in San Francisco. I'm here because I still – so I come home very frequently. I'm really close to my family. But more importantly, I was here today because I had a dentist appointment. And most of my like doctors and dentists are still at home because it's only 50 minutes away from San Francisco.
Okay. I thought maybe I discovered something.
No. I don't live at my parents' house.
Didn't you go for a membership model instead of selling individual courses, sell a monthly recurring revenue, have a monthly recurring revenue business the way that Ryan Carson, the way that Mixergy and so many others have done?
Yeah, I just really don't like the scalability of that opportunity. I think like when you're dealing with monthly subscriptions, there's a couple of So first of all, I think if I'm you, I would definitely do a monthly subscription. I think that the thing difference between Udemy and you is that we have thousands of mouths to feed, right? Like we have thousands of instructors who are teaching on our platform. And so instead of – so we can't afford really to be in a situation where we have to deal with splitting up that revenue amongst the instructors on a subscription model. I think that the purest way to go about this business was to allow instructors to be their own entrepreneurs. And as long as those teachers could be their own entrepreneurs, like they had to have a limitless upside to their individual revenue. So we viewed Kickstarter and Airbnb as a much closer proxy for what we were going to do business model wise than like lynda.com.
Lyft, I mentioned you're an advisor. I'm looking at my notes here. There's no sense asking you why you left the company. Even privately, neither you nor Aaron or anyone else has revealed why you left the company. I don't know what the big secret is.
We just agreed not to talk about it. Like it's one of those things that protects both sides. We agreed not to talk about it, and that's the best way to – if anybody ever deals with a situation where someone has to leave a company who's a fairly prominent member of that company, like that's the most professional way to deal with it.
Did you steal pens from the company and take them home?
I probably did, yes. That wasn't the reason. I had to leave, but that is definitely did happen.
I realized I did it right here
as well.
Let me do this and then ask you about growth hacking. I always have to do a plug at this point in the interview because it is by far the most important part of this whole interview for me to plug Mixergy Premium by saying, guys, go to mixergypremium.com. And if you do, first of all, I hope you're a member. If you're not, just sign up. You'll get access to hundreds of interviews, dozens of courses taught by real entrepreneurs. You can see Goggin used to listen when he started. Now he's back. Now he's starting a new business. He's listening. And I appreciate that, Goggin. And if you are a premium member, I'm going to suggest that you check out the lynda.com interview. It was fantastic because most people see where she is today. They don't remember the Lynda who was just a writer who started out with one course online and then built and built and built and built. And if you see her growth, I think it'll be inspiring. And as you've noticed, a lot of other people have signed up for it because it's also educational. You can see how she did it and how you, if you're interested in building an online business, can do it. I also recommend checking out Goggin's first interview because the guy had guts to say, I'm an outsider. I don't really have an idea, but I'm going to partner up with these guys who have this great idea. I'm going to help them. I'm going to grow this business and I'm going to get funding before I've even proven anything. And that's a great interview to go check out. What else? I guess check that out. And we have tons of other courses for you to go and explore on your own. Mixergypremium.com. I guarantee you'll love it. And if you don't love it, I'll give you your money back. And the reason that you can trust me is because Goggin would be embarrassed to be friends with me and he would kick my butt and he would call me out on it. And other people who are listening would kick my butt and call me out on it if I don't do right by you, the customer, the person who is funding this whole business, who's allowing me to have researcher and pre-interview process and everything else that we have here. So go to mixergypremium.com. I guarantee you'll love it. And I guarantee if you don't love it, that you'll get 100% of your money back.
Yeah, look, it's a no-brainer, guys. Like, honestly, if you are starting a company, you want to learn from the best entrepreneurs in the world. And one of the challenges with the other options out there is that they don't ask questions like Andrew does. And the reality is, he got more out of me in this interview than probably any reporter has in a long time. And the reason is because he knows what to ask and how to get it out of people. And that's the most valuable thing.
Thank you. And thank you for trusting me, by the way. We haven't finished, but one of the reasons why I don't reveal things that you guys don't want revealed is so that you trust me and get out the things that I think are important to talk about, important to reveal. Here's the thing. Growth hacking. I kind of, to be honest with the audience and with you, I called you a growth hacker at the top, and I used the phrase growth hacker throughout this interview because you've got a conference about growth hacking.
Yeah.
Before we talk about the conference, let's be explicit. What part of what you did at Udemy is growth hacking?
Yeah, I mean, people have very different terminology. And, you know, the term growth hacker, a lot of people who are actually good at marketing don't like it. And a lot of people who are good at marketing love it. It's really controversial right now. But ultimately what it is it's coming up with creative ways to scale a high growth company, particularly as it relates to product development and analytical thinking. As well as sort of internet marketing. So I think it combines those three things in a way, internet and mobile marketing. I think I always want to mention mobile nowadays because it's so important. But that's what growth hacking is. And so I would say that the way that we scaled our business in the early days is growth hacking. It was kind of like, you know, when we got all those people to teach courses through using interns, and then also when we had a massive team of like people who are going out and getting email lists and getting them to promote our course, that's a form of growth hacking. And then obviously paid acquisition is the way that we did paid acquisition and LTV analysis was as well.
A plain vanilla internet marketer would do what compared to a growth hacker with we now know how you built Udemy. What would a plain vanilla internet marketer have done that's different?
I think a plain vanilla internet marketer would have done a lot of the things we did in the early days, except for the intern strategy. That's something that's much more clearly a startup thing because you need a little bit of budget to do it usually. So the intern thing, scaling on the supply side is something I think most internet marketers would never know how to do really. And they would use their own personal networks actually for that kind of thing.
I see. And what you did was you had a team of interns call everybody who they can, who can teach, and recruit them to come on and teach.
Yeah, we created a highly leveraged sales funnel. I mean, this works for B2B or B2C companies. We basically figured out how to massively email people who were interested in our product, convince them to talk to us, and then sell them. Whereas right now, the way that most traditional marketing works is they try to cultivate leads via inbound marketing, like blog posts and stuff, which is also a form of growth hacking, but it's not it's a different form. And hope that they can network their way into companies to sell to them. We didn't need to do that because we were getting so much volume off of our process that we didn't need to deal with the deep level of effort for each individual sale.
When's the conference?
May 3rd in San Francisco.
May 3rd in San Francisco. And what do we learn if we go to the conference?
I mean, honestly, last year we put on the conference as a first time. Over 200 people bought tickets in the first 3 weeks, and so we sold out. And we had 200 people on the wait list. By the time the conference had started, we planned the whole thing in 5 weeks, very similar to this one. People loved it. They learned a lot of different things. You'll learn specific growth tactics from top entrepreneurs, people who led companies like Square, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. You'll get to meet some of the best growth hackers in the business. I mean, literally, I was looking at the attendee list the other day because I was trying to convince some sponsors to come. And I was like, I was shocked at who was coming to our conference. It's like, why do all these people want to come? But we're lucky enough to have that.
Who is some of the growth hackers who I can meet when I'm there?
I mean, I need to pull it up. Let me just pull up the website. I mean, so here are speakers, right? It's Keith Reboy, probably arguably one of the best angel investors of all time. And primarily focused on companies that have had massive growth. Josh Ellman, founder of the Twitter growth team. Elliot Schmuckler, who, if you've been following LinkedIn recently, he's the man behind all the like genius LinkedIn growth hacking that's been going on. Akash Garg, who's the director of engineering at the Twitter growth team.
What's LinkedIn doing? that you're amazed by?
Oh, man. I mean, almost like every couple of weeks I see a new thing on LinkedIn that I'm just like, wow, what geniuses.
Do you have an example?
They sent out an email. Sorry?
Do you have an example?
Yeah. They sent out an email at the beginning of this year thanking everyone who for a great 2012. And what they did in this email, and it changed depending on who it was and got it, but they like told you, gave you a timeline of the things that happened in 2012 with your colleagues, and that drove a ton of engagement. A couple weeks later, they sent out an email to the people who were in the top 1% and 10% and said, hey, you were in the top 1% of LinkedIn profiles viewed. Thank you for being a part of LinkedIn. So they cultivated their top groups.
And then they said, tweet out the fact that you were in our top 1% or 10%.
Exactly.
And when you've got such a big audience, 1 and 10% is a sizable number of people who are all tweeting.
Exactly. You're talking about basically LinkedIn getting in the forefront of the business conversation in social media in a way that very few companies ever can.
How about something smaller? Because I can see people in the audience going, all right, that's really impressive for LinkedIn. I don't have that big an audience. 1% of my audience is big. Do you have anything that would translate well to a smaller company?
So usually not, right? Because like when you have the size of LinkedIn, you're going to be doing tactics that are related to your size. But the thing that you want to learn from someone like who runs LinkedIn, and by the way, we intentionally bring people more like me into the conference. I always when I'm talking to people about why I should be a mentor, it's always because I'm much closer to the ground. I understand what the entrepreneurs are doing. So I totally agree with you, Andrew. You know, Elliot's not going to be the guy to teach you that stuff unless you're talking to him one-on-one. But what you will learn is what a best-in-class organization looks like from a growth perspective, and you can start to take elements of it. So how Elliot goes about A/B testing is something that is valuable for you. The actual test that he can run, probably not as valuable for you, so you got to figure out different tests.
I see what you're saying. And of course, it's always great to meet the people at the conferences. You and I reconnected and did this interview as a result of meeting at Jason Calacanis' conference. All right. Great conference. Of course, if you're there, go over and say hi to Gog and tell him you saw him on Mixergy and tell him that you heard him say that he sometimes pitches people on being their mentors. And maybe he'll end up being your mentor and tell him I say hi. Well, maybe even I'll see you there, Goggin. And everyone else.
Yeah, love to have you, Andrew, if you can.
Now that I'm living in San Francisco, it's a lot easier.
Totally.
Cool. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.
Awesome. Thank you. Take care.